Today we'll cover the Andrew effect. So the Andrew effect was discovered by Bill Andrew at UBC in 1976, shortly after Stephen Hawking's Hawking radiation paper. The Andrew effect says that if you take an ice cube and you accelerate it extremely strongly, then it'll melt, even if in the vacuum, even if it is in the cold of the vacuum at zero temperature. If the environment is at zero temperature, the ice cube will not agree with you that it is zero temperature. It will think that it will experience the environment as if it were hot. In other words, an inertial observer in Minkowski space would say that there are no particles around except for the ice cube. But the ice cube would say, what do you mean no particles? It's very hot here. All right? So let's calculate that. See, it's important for two reasons. One is its connection to Hawking radiation and via the equivalence principle, you know, acceleration and gravity. And on the other hand, because it sheds light on the very notion of what is a particle, it shows that one observer's particle may somebody else, maybe somebody else's vacuum. So here's the intuition. There are two ways to look at this, and I'll start with the way that is most natural for what we've done so far, and then we'll also look at it from a different angle. So consider again the surface of a lake, and we have a piece of cork that we put into the lake. Remember, we rigged the cork. We cut it there and put a spring there so that it can vibrate a bit. Now this rigged cork can act as a sender and receiver of information in that lake. If, for example, you have this cork in the water and you start it out in a pulled position, then it will snap back and create waves. And another cork, another place, would be able to register those waves. Because when these waves come along, it will shake the cork and will also, to some extent, trigger its internal oscillations. The point is that this cork can act as a detector of waves or detector of information, but also as an emitter of them. And we already discussed the intuition that when this cork is accelerated through the water, chances are that its internal degree of freedom gets excited this way. Whereas you could imagine that if you pull it at constant velocity through the water, if you do it very carefully, it would not be excited. So similarly, it is plausible, we'll have to check by calculating it, but it's plausible that if you take an atom in the vacuum of Minkowski space, at least it's a vacuum as far as inertial observers are concerned, if you take such an atom, it too has internal degrees of freedom. It too can get excited, just like this thing can get excited. The atom too can get excited. Electrons can be lifted to higher or lower orbits while absorbing or emitting energy. In fact, there is this proposal by Andrew, de Witt, and others that this could serve as the very definition of what is a particle. A particle is what a detector detects. So instead of speculating about what particles are philosophically, we can boil it down to something concrete. We can use a system as a detector of, let's say, photons. So you can view an atom as a detector for photons. And whenever the atom gets its state lifted, then we agree that it did so because it absorbed photons. But then, following this intuition, we should admit that not only will this atom be able to emit photons or absorb photons, also when we haul it around through the vacuum, especially if we do so in an accelerated fashion, then we would expect that the atom is not only causing radiation, it will also experience heat. It will also experience internal excitation because of the acceleration process. Of course, the energy for the excitation of the atom would come from whatever agent is accelerating the atom. So that is where the source of the energy is. Because remember, we may start out the atom in a ground state, we may start out the field in its vacuum state, and yet we might have processes that lift the atom energetically and also create photons, both of which are energetically expensive. That energy has to come from somewhere, and it will come from the agent that does the acceleration. But nevertheless, if we stick to the definition that a particle is what a particle detector detects, then we have to admit that an accelerated atom, if this holds true, then an accelerated atom will see particles where an inertial observer would not. And that's the Unruh effect. Okay, so let's consider this. We will consider...
Okay. Yeah? I had a question from last week regarding this. So in the usual QFT picture, the force carriers are these virtual particles that are interchanged between two interacting particles, right? So in order for a system to be accelerated, it needs to be kind of interchanging, or needs to be attached or interacting with another set of particles. So I was wondering, these particles that the system detects because it's being accelerated, are the particles that are accelerating?
No, it's independent. Very good question, but it's independent of that. You could imagine, for example, that there are different kinds of fields involved, and you use one kind of field to accelerate your detector, and what the detector is detecting is another kind of field. So, for example, you could have, I don't know, you could use the strong interaction to accelerate a nucleus, the nucleus and therefore the atom, but then you're observing electromagnetic excitation. So there is no direct link between the agent that does the acceleration and the detection of quanta from the field. The field that the detector is detecting need not be the field that is accelerating it. As you will see in the calculation, there is no reference to the agent that does the acceleration. We will simply assume it is accelerated whichever way. But you're right, of course, that the acceleration itself will require some interaction with some other field. But remember that if, for example, we did it electromagnetically, this could be very low frequency. It could basically be DC. It could be zero frequency. You just have a charge somewhere, a strong charge. And then an ion will on its own accelerate towards that. In this case, you have virtual photons around, but they will. It's basically... just very, very long wavelength photons that actually contribute to this, virtual photons that contribute to this. Whereas the detection of the Unruh effect would be the detection of, in principle, very high energetic photons if the acceleration is dramatic enough, the temperature could be high enough. So there are two different kinds of things. Okay, so we will consider these detectors. When I speak of detectors, it's synonymous with atoms or molecules or whatever local quantum system you use in place of the quark. So we'll consider detectors at rest and also in motion. So for example, a detector at rest would have this world line in four-dimensional Minkowski space. It would be moving only along the time axis, where tau is the eigentime, and then it would not be moving in the spatial directions. That's the detector at rest. A detector at constant velocity has this world line. It's A times the eigentime for the time direction and B vector times the eigentime in the spatial directions. And the coefficients A and the vector B have to obey this condition here. Do you know why that would be so? I leave it to you as an exercise. Let me just give you a hint. This is a special case of that. and then just do a Lorentz transformation. You see, in this case, you can tell that a squared minus b squared is 1, because only a is there, and a is 1. And then this is, oh, I'm giving it away. See, this is the inner product that's preserved by Lorentz transformation. So therefore, if it's true there, it's true there. Right? If this is the path in the Lorentz transformed frame. Okay, so then let's look at the case of also constant acceleration in the x direction. Now, I'm not giving that completely away. So now we have a detector that is accelerated in the x direction, and its time and space coordinates as a function of the eigentime of the detector, of the proper time of the detector, is given by these curves, where x2 and x3 are staying zero because the detector is only moving in the x1 direction. And I leave it to you as an exercise that this is really describing constant acceleration. I'm giving you some hints about this over here. Okay, so what's the quantum field like that we will have our detector move in? Well, we assume that for an inertial observer, the field phi is in the vacuum of Minkowski space. So we assume that an inertial observer sees nothing, no particles. Remember, that's the state where all the mode oscillators are in their ground state. The vacuum state, tensor product of all the ground states of all the mode oscillators. And we calculated what the field operator as a function of space and time is. Namely, we Fourier transformed it. Then we got these phi k, those individual mode oscillators. And the mode oscillators we wrote as linear combinations of A and A dagger operators with coefficient functions in front. And we found that these coefficient functions, by the way, we will call them mode functions, these coefficient functions, vk of the time, x naught is the time, are given by these plane waves, where omega k is square root of k squared plus m squared. And then we put it all together. We did put it all together, and we found, just a sec, what is this? Oh, yeah. And we found that phi of x, the field, the free quantum field, can be written as a function of space and time in this way. The complete solution to the quantum field theory, expressed in terms of A and A dagger operators, which we know how they act on the Fock spaces of all these mode oscillators. So that's the complete solution for a free quantum field. Now, of course, not going to be free, because we are going to have this detector in the field. And just like the cork was not only a passive observer of what was going on in the water, the cork was also creating waves. Similarly, when we put an atom into the quantum field, it too will interact with the quantum field. This is not going to be the exact solution anymore. The field and the detector system are going to interact with each other. It goes in both ways. In fact, the calculation that we will do today is the fundamental calculation for all atom field interactions. So we will study in principle, because we're not doing it for the electromagnetism, it has more vector indices and so on. But we will study in principle how you couple a quantum system such as an atom or a molecule to a quantum field, and how we can calculate the absorption and emission processes. And we will do it on such a general level that we will allow our atoms and molecules to be on arbitrary trajectories. So if you're just interested in absorption and emission, just choose an atom at rest. But the Andrew effect will require knowledge of how to do field matter, radiation matter interaction calculations, also when the matter, in this case an atom, is accelerated. Okay, but let's keep that in mind, because it will come in very handy to know that the free evolution of the quantum field is given by this exact expression that we've calculated before. The quantum field operator phi hat of x and its time derivative pi hat of x, as well as all the a's and the a daggers of the modes, they all act on the Hilbert space of the field, which we will give the name H field. Okay? We will also have a Hilbert space for the detector. And the total system consisting of the two systems will be acting on, will be living on the tensor product of the two Hilbert spaces. So here we have a detector system. It could be an atom or a molecule or even something larger than that. So it's the detector system, or often also called Unruh-DeWitt detector system, is required to be a small localized system which has a well-defined path x mu of tau, where tau is the proper time of the detector, and that's the world line that it travels in. The x mu we will choose to be the Cartesian coordinates in Minkowski space as observed by an inertial observer. So this is not going to be polar coordinates or something funny like that. It's just the usual Cartesian coordinates for an inertial observer. And that tau is going to be the proper time or the eigentime of the detector as it travels along. So it could be an atom, but it could also be a molecule, for example, H2, diatomic molecule. It has a vibrational degree of freedom where the two nuclei have an almost harmonic potential relative to each other around the equilibrium position. And again, there you could use the excitations of that molecule as a detector. Namely, it would be a detector for photons whose energy is matching the energy gap of that molecule. Similarly here, for an atom, you know, it can pick up photons of its resonance frequencies. So you know, the energy gap between energy levels could be bridged by photons, and that's how you detect photons. We will describe the detector system, and that is why we do it first quantized. In principle, of course, it would have to be done second quantized. Full quantum electrodynamics of the electrons, the quarks, and the whole thing, but that would be extremely difficult to do. And so, well, but it turns out that it's a very good approximation to just treat this as a first quantized field, if what we are after is not ultra accurate calculations of energy levels, but instead, if what we are after is detecting photons in the field. So this is just a crude detector, of which we don't require it to be perfect, but we will describe the field, the Klein-Gordon field, completely accurately without any simplification. So then the first quantized system of the atom will have a Hamiltonian, just like the quantum field has its Hamiltonian. Also the detector system will have its Hamiltonian. Let's call it H superscript detector. And it acts on its Hilbert space, H, curly H, superscript detector. We will assume that the spectrum of the detector system is discrete. We don't strictly have to do that, but it simplifies the calculations. In practice, of course, none of the detector systems that you could cook up in real life would have a completely discrete spectrum. For example, the hydrogen atom has, it has infinitely many discrete eigenvalues, but on top of that sits a continuum, which is when the hydrogen atom is being ripped apart. These are the scattering states. But in practice, we will drill down in our calculations to very specific processes. For example, the process of the detector detecting a photon of a particular wave vector, a particular energy, because that's one of its energy gaps. So we will just be interested really in one of those energy gaps there. And of course, if we choose the detector system to be starting out in an excited state, well, then you could also have a decay, which means then you can calculate the probability for the detector system to emit a photon. It's all the same math, all the same approach that we will cover now. So the total quantum system consists of two subsystems. The total Hamiltonian, is the Hamiltonian of the detector system, tensor the identity on the field Hilbert space, plus the identity operator on the detector's Hilbert space, tensor the Hamiltonian acting on the quantum fields Hilbert space, plus an interaction Hamiltonian that will act on both simultaneously. This is a Hamiltonian that will entangle the two systems, the quantum field and the detector. So this total Hamiltonian will act on the total Hilbert space, which is just the tensor product of the two Hilbert spaces of the detector and the quantum field. Now, what does the interaction Hamiltonian look like? Remember, the interaction Hamiltonian will act on this total space non-trivially. Well, in order to act non-trivially on both systems, and therefore in order for them to have a non-trivial interaction with each other, we will need that the interaction Hamiltonian consists of non-trivial operators out of both quantum systems. So the interaction Hamiltonian will be of the form an operator of the quantum field and an operator of the quantum of the Androidi detector. So this could also be pi. It doesn't have to be phi. It could also be some other expression in terms of phi and pi. But in practice, we might as well choose phi. Things wouldn't dramatically change if we took pi. In realistic scenarios where you actually use, let's say, the electromagnetic interaction, or where you use the strong or weak interaction, you get all kinds of combinations there. For the electromagnetic interaction, for example, you could have a coupling to the B field with a momentum, for example. The momentum of an atom, which would correspond to a current that would couple to the magnetic field, and the magnetic field is the pi of the electromagnetic field. But you can also couple to the electromagnetic potential, for example, and then it would be more like a phi. Anyway, so we take an operator and we will choose the phi of the Hilbert space of the quantum field, and an operator, we won't actually have to specify exactly which operator it is, some operator of the detector, system. And also for convenience, we will multiply the interaction Hamiltonian with a function epsilon of tau, where epsilon of tau is what is called the switching function, or also the detector efficiency function. It's a function, and the reason why we call it epsilon is that to indicate that it's supposed to be of small amplitude. The interaction is supposed to be weak. The interaction between the detector and the field is supposed to be weak, and we assume that so that we can use perturbation theory. We will do a calculation to first order in epsilon, because you can always improve on the accuracy by going to second and higher orders in epsilon. But it's not just going to be a small number. It's going to be a function of time as well. And that will allow us to, it's just a convenient trick. So an alternative to giving bounds on integrals later on. It basically is a tool so that we can formally switch on and off the interaction. You could imagine having an atom fielded and then you open it up. It's in a box, then it cannot interact. You open it up and it can interact. So it's a formal tool to switch the interaction on and off. Ultimately, because if you remember our previous calculations, it's often useful to separate the in scenario from the out scenario and the complicated goings on while the interactions happen. And so having an epsilon of tau that's non-zero only on a finite interval, for example, we will establish clean in and out regions of the interaction if we want to do so. So concrete examples would be, for this interaction Hamiltonian, could imagine an interaction Hamiltonian where, for example, the operator that we use in the Hilbert space of the detector system could be a spin, because it is sensitive to magnetism. You could then have a B3, which would be, it doesn't have to be B3, I'm just choosing it like that. So it could be the third spin component and the third magnetic field component of the electromagnetic field. So the B field operator would be taking that role, And the S3, the spin operator of an atom, for example, would be playing this role. And in this case, the detection of a particle would be the detection of a spin flip. Alternatively, the interaction Hamiltonian could also be up to a prefactor, the momentum operator of an electron in an atom, and the electromagnetic field if you choose the Coulomb gauge, for example. But in practice, we will work with this, just phi, Klein-Gordon phi, and some operator Q. We will leave open exactly which operator that is. You can fill that in with the application at hand. So what then is the time evolution? Remember that we have the exact solution for the quantum field's evolution if we leave it alone. But we won't leave it alone. We will put this detector system in there, and that can create waves and detect waves. It's an active player. So what we will do is we will assume that the detector efficiency, the strength of the coupling between the atom and the field, is weak, and then we can apply perturbation theory. And further, we will use the Dirac picture of time evolution. Now, are you all familiar with the Dirac picture? Who's very familiar with the Dirac picture? Yeah? All right. Okay. The thing is, if you are not completely familiar with the Dirac picture, do send me an email. And I'll send you lecture notes of mine about quantum mechanics. And there I discuss the Schrödinger picture, Heisenberg picture, and the Dirac picture as well. So you can refresh the knowledge of the Dirac picture. So we will use the Dirac picture. Here, just the basics of it. In the Dirac picture, the time evolution operator is split in such a way that it's not completely only the operators that involve in time. It's not completely, as would be the case for the Heisenberg picture, it's not entirely true that it's just the vectors evolve in time, as it would be the case for the Schrödinger picture. No, it's a mix between the two. In the Dirac picture, we split the time evolution in such a way that the operators of the theory will evolve according to the free Hamiltonian, the total but free Hamiltonian. So we have that the operators of the quantum theory, of the total quantum theory, evolve according to the free Hamiltonian of the atom plus the free Hamiltonian of the field. You see, the unitary time evolution operator for that system can easily be calculated because it's just the free evolution of the atom, and the hydrogen atom has been completely solved. And the free evolution of the quantum field, we have the complete solution of that as well. So, for example, when we take the operator that is in the interaction Hamiltonian, the certain observable of the atom, then what is its time evolution? Well, it's going to be the unitary time evolution operator of the generated by this total evolution, acting on the observable at the initial time, tensor 1. Because remember that when I write here an operator that acts in a total system, it always is acting on a tensor product. So really, Q of tau at the initial time is Q naught tensor 1. I should really write the tensor 1 here too. I hope you're not confused by me sometimes dropping tensor 1. Okay, it's just generally done in the literature that multiplying with a tensor multiplying with the identity is dropped. Okay, so we have the free evolution with respect to the free Hamiltonian. This is just canceling out in here because when we evolve the identity operator on the quantum field space, well, if you exponentiate this, we get a unitary, and the unitary times its Hermitian conjugate is just the identity. So overall, what we get is the evolution of the detector's observable Q hat is simply by the unitary time evolution operator of the free atom. And for example, if we could diagonalize the Hamiltonian of the hydrogen atom, we know how to do that, in which case in the we can choose the energy eigenbasis, and in that case these become just phases if you choose that basis. Okay, so how the quantum field and how the detector system are evolving in time is known. We can use it from the literature or from our prior calculations. This is how the detector system, the unruly-bit detector, is evolving in time. The quantum field is evolving in time as we saw earlier, namely, This is the time evolution of the quantum field. So we have that. But that is just time evolution according to the free motion. In the Dirac picture, the non-triviality is in the evolution of the states. The states of the total system now evolve according to just the interaction Hamiltonian. They evolve according to the interaction Hamiltonian alone. So we have to write down the Schrödinger equation where the Hamiltonian is only the interaction Hamiltonian. Okay? That gives us the time evolution of the state. So in other words, the time evolution operator that acts on the states in the Dirac picture is given by exponentiating the interaction Hamiltonian. Now, if the interaction Hamiltonian is constant in time, then this integral just becomes, you know, h interaction times tau final minus tau initial. Easy, then it's no longer, I mean, the integration is then easy if that's just a constant. But if it's not a constant, then remember that we have to integrate this. And remember that we have to use this time ordering operator here in front to make sure that the Schrödinger equation holds. You see, if you differentiate, the time evolution operator has to obey the Schrödinger equation. So I times the derivative of, the time derivative of u has to be h interaction times this. Now you might think, okay, why would I need this time ordering operator here? If I differentiate this with respect to time, tau final, then don't I just get h interaction here in front of it and that's easy? Not really. And the reason is that when the interaction Hamiltonian is time dependent, it may not commute with itself at different times. And therefore, the Schrödinger equation is not automatically obeyed by this expression. In order to make it automatically obeyed, we have to use this time ordering symbol, which makes sure that the H interaction Hamiltonian at the latest time is always to the leftmost in whatever products come up when we exponentiate this expression here. Anyway, I hope you remember this sort of thing from quantum mechanics. If not, again, send me an email, I'll send you lecture notes. Okay, so the point is, the operator in the Dirac picture, also called the interaction picture, which is particularly suitable for perturbation theory, the operators evolve according to the free Hamiltonian. The states evolve according to the interaction Hamiltonian alone. There's one thing that students often overlook. Let me point it out. It's true that the states evolve according to the interaction Hamiltonian, but it has to be the interaction Hamiltonian in the Dirac picture, which means that the operators that occur in the interaction Hamiltonian have to be evolving in time according to the free evolution. Right? So they're not frozen as in the Schrödinger picture. They are evolving in time. Okay, so let's just keep that in mind. Otherwise, we wouldn't get the formulas right that we will soon calculate. Okay, so we'll do a perturbative ansatz. We will assume that the detector efficiency epsilon of tau is small, so the coupling between matter and radiation is relatively weak. In the case of electromagnetism, for example, you know that this coupling constant in front of the matter of the electron-photon coupling is the fine structure constant, which is 1 over 137, which is a quite small number. So similarly, we assume here that this coupling constant is small. In this case, the time evolution operator, namely this thing, the thing that evolves the states in the Dirac picture, can be expanded. You see, if we write this out, we have to write the power series expansion of the exponential and make sure that we order the Hamiltonian of it correctly. Now, if you write out this power series expansion of the exponential, then the lowest order term is, of course, a 1. That's here. See, I'm expanding, Taylor expanding here the exponential. And the next order term is just this whole thing. You know, the exponential is 1 plus x squared over 2 factorial plus x to the third over 3 factorial, etc. So the lowest order terms are 1 plus the linear term, and then plus stuff where you would have the square of the integral term here, suitably ordered. So what is nice here is that if we calculate only to first order, as we will do now, then we don't actually have to worry about the time ordering operator because there's only one occurrence of this expression. So we don't have to commute this expression with another copy of itself at different times. That will only appear at higher order. Okay, so to lowest order in perturbation theory, to lowest non-trivial order in perturbation theory, to lowest, well, lowest really order in perturbation theory, we would drop the linear term. And the time evolution operator would be just the identity, and there's no interaction. So to next order, this is the interaction that we get. So we can set here the initial time. See, we had here initial time and final time. But really, we can choose the initial time to be minus infinity. The final time we can choose to be tau f, or plus infinity. It doesn't matter because it's so convenient that we have this switching function here, right? If we, the integral will be automatically confined to the region where the epsilon is not zero. So by choosing the epsilon of tau appropriately, we can arrange for any interaction period that we want. In fact, you may think that this is some sort of tedious bookkeeping device only, but it's not really. Because it turns out that a detector will click and detect particles. I mean, that's by definition, right? Let me just say it will click. A detector will click not only when photons obviously travel to the detector and get absorbed. That would be the obvious thing that everybody expects. And of course, the detector will also click when it is accelerated. That's the whole point of the calculation that we do today. But there is another instance too when it will detect particles, or at least it will click. And you might interpret that as a detection of particles. And that instance is when you switch the detector. Let's say you take a detector and you have it always on. Then there really should be only two instances why it clicks. One is, well, some particles, as described by inertial observers, are hitting the detector and getting absorbed. Or the Andrew effect kicks in, and the detector is clicking because it's being accelerated. But, and that's where this epsilon comes in. Imagine you have a detector that's not accelerated, and the whole thing is playing in the vacuum. But you switch on the detector only very briefly. Very briefly. Switch it on and switch it off again. So this is, let's say, a very sharp Gaussian or something like that, or even a step function. It turns out, then too, the detector can click, just because it was switched. And the interpretation of that is that this is the time energy uncertainty principle at work. See, if you switch it on and off very quickly, then you know when the detector clicked, if it clicked at all. But if you know when something happens, you cannot know exactly what energy it had. And that energy fluctuation, that energy uncertainty, allows the detector to actually click. And of course, the energy comes from the switching process again. It comes externally. So what we will see is, in this calculation that we will now perform, we will see all those three phenomena acting at once, simultaneously, being going on at the same time. Namely, absorption and emission of the usual kind. Acceleration can trigger the detector, but also the switching can trigger the detector. All right, so let us set initial conditions. Let us assume that the quantum field starts out in a state alpha. And if we choose alpha to be the Minkowski vacuum, then that's just one choice, right? So that would be the state where all the field oscillators are in the ground state. All the mode oscillators of the field are in the ground state. Or we might also, for example, choose the field to start out in a state which is a one particle state. You could also consider, for example, the state where the field has one photon present with wave vector k. That would be the state alpha equal 1k, which means that the mode oscillator to wave vector k is in its first excited state, and all the other mode oscillators are in the ground state. And of course, you could have much more complicated states too. But the point is that if you start with the vacuum state, then you only get clicking of the detector because of acceleration or because of switching. If you start the field in an excited state, in other words, if there's a photon present, then of course the detector could click because there's a photon present, because it absorbed that photon. We will mostly focus on the case where the field starts out in the vacuum state, because then only the under effect can make it click, or the switching process can make it click. But the calculation that you will do will cover the case of regular absorption too. Just start out the field with particles in it, with photons in it, and the detector has a chance to click, even without being accelerated, even without being switched. Okay, so let's, so in other words, we leave open the initial state for the field, also our preference is going to be the vacuum. And for the detector system, our preference is going to be that it starts out in the lowest energy state of the detector. So if the detector system is an atom, we assume it to be in its ground state. Again, you could choose it to be in its first excited state. In that case, you can use our calculation later on to calculate what the probability is for that atom to decay to its ground state while emitting a photon. Notice that this is going well beyond what you could possibly calculate in quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, if you have an eigenstate of the hydrogen atom, let's say the hydrogen atom is in its first excited state. According to Schrödinger quantum mechanics, it will always stay in that first excited state because it is an energy eigenstate of the Schrödinger atom. So, yeah, I mean, why would it go to another state? It's an eigenstate. Will always be in the first excited state if you prepare it in the first excited state. Because in practice it doesn't. The atom does decay. Now from our new vantage point, why does it decay? Well, the reason is that the state of the obtained as the tensor product of the ground of the first excited state, let's say, of the atom and the vacuum state of the electromagnetic field, that total state is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian of the atom, all right. It's also an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian of the electromagnetic field. But it's not an eigenstate of the total Hamiltonian. That includes the interaction between the two. That's why an excited atom will decay. It's the interaction Hamiltonian for which the eigenstates of the atom alone are not truly eigenstates. They're not eigenstates of the total Hamiltonian. Okay, so the combined system state, we will assume to start out in, let's say, the ground state of the atom and some state of the quantum field. As I said, you could choose an excited state of the atom, and in that case, what we are calculating is the probability for emission. But our focus is going to be the under effect. So what's then the time evolution? Well, after a while, at time tau, the total system consisting of the ordinary wave detector and the quantum field is going to be in the state psi of tau, which is psi initial. Remember, psi initial was this state, psi initial acted upon by the time evolution operator. That time evolution operator, because we are working in the Dirac picture, is the exponentiation of the interaction Hamiltonian alone. And the interaction Hamiltonian will consist of operators that evolve according to the Heisenberg picture, right? So the operators in this will evolve according to the free Hamiltonians of field and detector. Okay, so we are concerned with particle creation. The problem is this. What is the probability amplitude that if we measure at time tau the detector system, it will be in an excited state? So remember, we start out the detector in its ground state, and then we ask, what's the probability for finding later on the detector in an excited state En? We will interpret that as the detection of particles. To calculate this, all we have to do is calculate the overlap between the state that the total system is going to be in at time tau and the state that we are looking for. The state that we are looking for is excited state of the detector and some state of the quantum field. We don't really care what state it might be. Right? So we prepare the system in, let's say, the ground state of the detector and some state of the field, such as the vacuum state. Then we evolve it forward in time. Then we get psi of tau. And then we calculate the overlap with a situation where the detector is excited and the field is in some state. And we'll have to find out what the possible state, what the states possibly could be that the field is in. I mean, what would we expect? We might expect that if, because of acceleration, the detector gets excited, the field probably also gets excited. Right? If you have that quark and you accelerate it, well, yes, it will make the internal degree of the freedom, the internal degree of freedom of the quark vibrate, but you'll also create waves in the process. So what we should expect is that the probability for finding the particle excited will be non-zero when we choose here also not the vacuum state, but some excited state. So, how do we calculate that detection probability? So let's assume we run this for all time. That's why we put here infinity. So we let it interact for all time. We start out the system in the ground state of the detector, the hydrogen atom, and some state of the quantum field. Here we have the time evolution operator. Remember, to lowest non-trivial order and perturbation theory, it is simply 1 plus I times, and then here's the interaction Hamiltonian. And remember that this operator, because we're using the Dirac picture, evolves according to the free evolution of the detector system. That is evolving according to the free evolution of the quantum field. We have the explicit solution for this, and we can write down the explicit solution for that in principle as well. Okay, so that's the initial state. This is the initial state time evolved. And that's the state that we're looking for. We're asking, you know, what's the probability for finding this the detector excited in state En, which might be the first excited state, but it could be another excited state too. It depends on what energy photon you absorb, whether you go up to the first, second, or whatever energy level. Okay, so that's the probability amplitude, not the probability, but probability amplitude, right? Because it's the overlap function that we have here. The modulus square of that is the probability amplitude. So that's what we have to calculate. Now notice that the tensor products neatly separate in this. We have here the En and the Q hat and the E naught forming one matrix element. And then the omega, the phi hat, and the alpha are happening in the other Hilbert space. In particular, we have that the En and 1 and E naught vanishes, because that's the overlap between two orthogonal states, the ground state and an excited state. So what we see here is that this term drops out right away, just because no matter what the inner product is between omega and alpha, what the overlap is, no matter what the overlap is, that overlap is zero already. So the term 1 goes away, which is intuitive, right? It says that if there's nothing happening, if there's no interaction, because that's the term with one, if there's no interaction, we don't expect any excitation. Okay. Then, let us put the factors together. We find that we have the epsilon of tau integrated from minus infinity to plus infinity, and then in the first Hilbert space, this is happening, enqe0, that's that, enqe0, and then in the second Hilbert space, we have omega, phi, and alpha. We will treat that case in a moment. For now, let us look at this. This is a so-called transition matrix element from E0, from ground state to an excited state. And we have here the Q, which is an observable in the Hilbert space of the detector. And because we are working in a Dirac picture, it evolves according to the free evolution of the detector. In other words, Q hat of tau is given by e to the power of I, and then it's the H naught of the detector, the free Hamiltonian of the detector, Q naught, the initial operator at time zero, and then here we have the Hermitian conjugate of that factor here. Okay, so let's put that in there. What do we obtain? See, we have here the exponentiation of the free Hamiltonian of the detector system, of the atom. And here too. And what are they acting on? They're acting on eigenstates of energy. In other words, this operator gets replaced by its eigenvalue because it's acting on an eigenvector, and similarly here. Therefore, that initially perhaps complicated looking expression simplifies to simply this. We get e to the power of I en, that is from having this factor acting on the left. The En is the eigenvalue over here. So we get that minus what we get when we have this factor acting here on the right. That just gives us this number, e to the power of minus I E naught tau. Okay. And we are left with the only non-trivial Hilbert space business is En and then the Q naught and E naught. So we are left with this matrix element over here. What the value of that is will depend on what operator the Q is. And in practice, it could be something like the momentum operator or some spin operator or whatever. It turns out we won't actually need to specify that. If you want to calculate an explicit process for an explicit system, yes, then you will need to know what your Q naught is. But for deriving the Unruh effect, fortunately, all we need to know is it's some number, right? Just some number. This is the interesting part because it has a time dependence and an energy dependence in it. Okay, so we simplified now this expression, or maybe not simplified, but we made it more explicit, this expression by working on that factor here. It turned out to be just this exponential times that business here. Now, let us look into this thing here. Here we have the overlap of omega phi alpha. Remember, alpha is the state that we prepared the quantum field in. Omega is the state that the quantum field will be in after the, or may be in, after the interaction. Right? Remember, we are asked, what we are calculating here is the probability for finding after the interaction this state, En tensor omega. Okay? It's just a guess, En tensor omega. We want to know what's the probability of actually finding that. So here we have phi hat of x and tau. Remember, we know what that is. According to the free evolution, and that's what we need in the Dirac picture, this operator, phi hat of x and tau, is given by this expression. If you remember early on in the lecture, I reviewed that. It's a complete solution of the Klein-Gordon theory in the free case in Minkowski space. So we just have to put that in here now. So we plug that expression into here. And you can see how that's getting a little complicated now, because we have so many terms that go into this. But it turns out that this will simplify. Notice, by the way, that the equation in the blue box is really all you need. I mean, together with this, is really all you need to be able to calculate all emission and absorption processes. Because it tells you the probability for a transition from the initial state E naught alpha, and you get to choose what those two states are, to going into the out state, final state, omega En, and again, you get to choose what those two states are. And then that's explicit. For example, if we were talking about the hydrogen atom, the Q naught might be the momentum operator. These are energy eigenstates. So for particular orbitals, you're calculating a particular integral here. Can do this explicitly. And this expression you can work out with this. Now, here we will focus on particle detection in the vacuum. So from now on, let's assume that the initial state of the quantum field is actually the vacuum here. Okay. Now, if this is the vacuum, if we choose this to be the vacuum, then we can immediately tell that only particular field states are possible to be found later on. Namely, see, if this is the vacuum state, and this is that field, then notice that the field contains something times a dagger plus something times a. This term will be gone. It dies because it acts on the vacuum, and here we have a. Okay, so that term is not going to contribute to our probability. That term is gone. Only this term has a chance to produce a non-zero probability, because here we have an a dagger acting on the vacuum. Okay, so after the field acts on the vacuum, we will have here a linear combination of one particle states in the quantum field. There's going to be one a dagger acting on the field. Therefore, the omega has to be a one particle state too. Otherwise, it's going to be orthogonal to this, and therefore the probability for finding it would be zero. This means we can restrict attention to omegas, to final states, which are of the form AK acting on the vacuum, or a linear combination of them. We can restrict attention to final states of the field that are proportional to AK acting on AK dagger acting on the vacuum, because as we just said, this term doesn't contribute yet, annihilates there. What this means is that when we accelerate our detector, it can emit at most one photon. Just a sec. Oh, really? According to this calculation, yes, right? The only possible out states for the quantum field are states with one particle present. Because otherwise, this omega would be orthogonal to that. But that seems unlikely. If you take a charge and move it widely, accelerate it widely around, you would expect to be able to create more than one photon. And you can, just not to lowest order in perturbation theory. Right? If you go to higher order in perturbation theory, you would have higher powers of phi because you have higher powers of the Hamiltonian. And then you get higher powers of a dagger, and then you get more photons. So what you see here is that you are most likely to find just one, but you know, if you're doing really wide accelerations, you can have more excitation as well.
My question was similar to the thing you answered, but then there's an integration over tau. Does that complicate the picture? I mean, you first start off with a vacuum state, and then you create a particle. Then you're integrating over tau, can't you just keep on creating more particles on the stage weight?
Well, yes, intuitively, that is right. But we are assuming here that we can stick within first order perturbation theory. So what you're saying is that if the interaction is on for a long time, then we would expect that more particles can be created, which means that our approximation becomes suspicious. Right? So basically, within this approximation, it's strictly true. you can only describe processes where the acceleration will create exactly one photon, right? But it's lowest order perturbation theory, and you have to check case by case if your interaction is either weak enough or short enough so that this perturbation, so that this result is actually the dominant one. So that it actually is the only one that matters. But in practice, that's actually a very good approximation. The reason being that the Andrew effect is really very weak. We are nowhere near experimentally, as we discussed at the end of the previous lecture. We cannot really cleanly produce the Andrew effect in the lab. The accelerations are small enough. The effect is small enough. We would be happy to see that just the one photon, the lowest order effect.
We would get things of higher powers of epsilon as well. Basically, we're using the Dyson series.
Yes, that's right.
And because this is only first order, that's what you want to see.
Yes, exactly. First order and epsilon, that's what it is. Right. Okay. So that means we can restrict attention to omega, to outstate. To outstates omega, which are of the form A dagger K acting on the vacuum. So the total field state is always of the form that it is a coefficient times the vacuum plus some integral over one particle states plus some integral over coefficients times two particle states plus integral over coefficients and three particle states, etc. And all of those contributions vanish in that integral here, because this is a one particle state, and all the n particle states with n not equal 1 will be orthogonal to it. So all of those terms vanish except for this thing. Okay, so let us assume, let us ask for the probability for finding the out state, which is one photon emitted with momentum k tilde, so this is the out state of the field, and of course the detector in the state En. So in this case, the probability for finding all that, for finding the system in the out state with, so this is the out state omega now, it's the A dagger tilde, A dagger k tilde acting on the vacuum. The dagger is lost because we have it on this state here. Yeah, that's the probability then, right? Because we've now put this whole expression up in here and chosen here the one particle state with momentum k. So we obtain these factors. And here we have the A k tilde and the A dagger k. And there is going to be a Dirac delta, because the vacuum expectation value of A and A dagger K and K tilde is given by this using the commutation relations between A and A dagger. And then this annihilates the vacuum state. So we are just left with a Dirac delta. And so we obtain that finally, the probability for the ground state of the detector and the vacuum state of the field to turn through the time evolution, through the interaction between the two of them, into a state where the detector is in the energy eigenstate En, and the field has now one photon of momentum k tilde, that probability amplitude is here. Remember, here is this matrix element that we would need to know exactly what the interaction Hamiltonian is like to actually calculate that, but it's just a number. And here we have to carry out that integral. And notice that there's nothing about the Hilbert space left over. We worked out all the overlap functions, all the matrix elements there. So we are just left with some integral here. In fact, it looks pretty much like a Fourier transform, because we have e to the power of something times tau. So that's the formula for creating particles out of nothing, right? In a sense, because, you know, ground state of the detector, vacuum of the field, and then we find a photon is there with momentum k tilde, and the detector is in the excited state En. That's the probability for this happening. Now, let's see when it can happen. First, let us look at the case where the field starts out in the vacuum again. Of course, we've already specialized to that. And assume that the detector is inertial. Well, if the detector is inertial, then we can go in its rest frame. And in its rest frame, its world line is this. That's x mu of tau. Let us put that in here. Oh, you may wonder, where did the world line enter into all this? You wonder that? Right. Okay, remember, we had that the interaction Hamiltonian, maybe I should have highlighted that. Okay, so here's the interaction Hamiltonian, for example, here, right? Interaction Hamiltonian. And you see, here is an observable of the detector multiplying the field. But where? The detector is interacting with the field at the location where the detector is. So it's phi of x and tau. That's how the path of the detector entered. See, here we have phi of x and tau, and we know what phi of x is for all times and locations, but we have to take it at the world line of the detector. So this becomes x naught of tau, this becomes x vector of tau, and so on. Okay, so that was our result here. And you notice here x naught of tau, x vector of tau. Let's assume now that the detector, that our atom, is inertial. Well, if it is inertial, that's the world line of the detector. So that means that the x naught of tau is just tau. And the x vector, what a relief, is just zero. So that term goes away. And therefore, the equation in the blue box becomes this one. So we have that the probability, infinity means over all time, that the detector gets excited and the field suddenly has a photon, is calculated in this way, where we have now x naught of tau, x vector of tau, and we assume that the detector efficiency function, the switching function, is always 1. Actually, it should really be a small number. Let's just say it's called epsilon naught or whatever. But the point is we will leave it always on. In this way, the epsilon of tau just becomes a constant. We also have, as I already said, that the x vector of tau goes away because we are in the rest frame of an inertial observer, of an inertial detector. And then our integral that calculates the probability is just this one. And that really is just a Fourier transform, right? In fact, it's a Fourier transform of the function 1, right? Because it's just a Fourier factor, e to the power of en minus e naught plus omega k, right? And what is the Fourier transform of a plane wave? Right? It's a Fourier transform of a Fourier factor times the identity. That's what it is. Now, the integral over just a plane wave, of course, gives us a Dirac delta function. So what we obtain is that the probability for this process to happen, ground state of the detector, tensor vacuum of the field, going into excited detector, excited field, that the probability for this to happen becomes proportional to this Dirac delta function, where the argument is En minus E naught plus omega k. And that Dirac delta function is never zero. It never contributes. The probability for the detector to get excited out of nothing is zero, as it should be. And why mathematically? Well, you see, En, the excited state, is certainly of larger energy than the ground state. So this is a positive number. And omega k is also always positive, so never peaking. But notice that we have never used, in our calculations before, we never used that En is actually larger than E naught. If you did the same calculation, simply assuming that the detector starts out in an excited state, and you ask what's the probability for it to be found in the ground state, just reinterpret what the En and what the E naught means. And then you see that, yes, it can peak. It can peak, because if this one is smaller than that one, right, if you just swap the row, then that becomes negative. It can peak, and when will it peak? Well, when the detector gap energy is exactly the h bar omega of a photon that needs to be absorbed to do it, right? that will be emitted, right? So what would happen is that the detector system goes from excited state to ground state, and the electromagnetic field would go from vacuum to having one photon present of energy h bar omega k. And very similarly, could you calculate, of course, both emission and absorption processes with any number of particles. Now, before we move on, let me make the point that we set epsilon of tau to a constant here. The switching function was constant. But imagine now you switch it. Imagine now you switch the detector on and off, some sort of Gaussian switching function or a step function even. Well, in that case, you don't really have here the integral over the real line of that Fourier factor, but just over a window. And what's that going to be? It's going to be a sinc function, sine x over x, right? And so instead of having a Dirac delta, we're going to have something wishy-washy here. And that means we have a probability for finding excitation, even when both start out in a ground state, the detector and the field. Because it's no longer a Dirac delta then, right? If it's just a box function, then the Fourier transform of it is going to be a sinc. It's not as sharply peaked as a Dirac delta. And that is an expression of the time energy uncertainty principle. Natasha?
So this is the probability of having the detector excited and the field excited.
Correct. Except if you reinterpret what the EN and
E
naught
are. Exactly. So we can have two possibilities to make this non-zero. Either you start with an excited state of a detector and then it decays.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Or with a
little. You start with an excited state of the field.
Yes.
And then this kind of.
Correct. But you would have to, in principle, go through the calculation again because we really used that the field started out in a vacuum state. We dropped the term and so on. But you're right. In principle, that, yeah, same thing goes through. But, as I said, you can also have excitation now, even in the inertial case, just because you're switching. And that's the time-energy uncertainty principle. Now, let's see if we can have excitation. If we can have a sort of weakening up of this Dirac delta. You see, the Dirac delta kills us. If we start out with a ground state and of the field and the detector, and we ask what's the probability for excitation, then if it's all inertial, then the probability of excitation is zero. The Dirac delta kills us. But having a window function for when the detector is on, so knowing something about localization in time, will make the energy fuzzy and will allow us to find some excitation there. That's one way of softening up the Dirac delta. And we will find out that acceleration is another way. You can always have that on, so you're not using that trick of the switching and localization in time. But instead, acceleration two is basically just doing the same thing. It's softening up the Dirac delta so that we can have excitations then too. So let us look at the special case where, again, we start out with the vacuum state for the field, ground state of the detector, and the detector is moving non-inertially. Remember, that was the claim. You pull on a ice cube extremely fast. If it accelerated extremely fast, it ought to melt, even in the cold of the vacuum. It ought to boil off. So the probability amplitude for the detector to become excited will depend on the excitation energy, En minus E naught, the energy gap of the detector, of course. That's the usual factor here. This, again, is just a constant here. And now we have this function here, where we simply didn't no longer drop that term. We dropped that term earlier because the system was inertial, but now we can no longer drop that term. Instead, we have to put in here the full trajectory of an accelerated detector. It could be the detector curve that I gave you earlier today with the sinh and the cosine and the cosine hyperbolic sine and hyperbolic cosine constant acceleration case. You can plug it in there and go through the calculations. But it doesn't have to be constant acceleration for the point that we want to make now. You see, for generic accelerated detectors, be that constant acceleration or non-constant acceleration, this function here will possess a Fourier transform, and that is what matters, which is not going to be a Dirac delta, even if this thing is constant. If this is a generic function, then it's not of the form of a plane wave. It's not e to the power I constant times tau. But that is what would be needed in order to get a Dirac delta. So there will be a Fourier transform, which is generally non-zero for positive Ex. You see, we can't say that all the probability amplitudes will be non-zero when you accelerate, because the Fourier transform of that function can go through zero sometimes. For some values of Ex, the Fourier transform, see, when you calculate that expression here, remember, here's the full thing. Basically, this expression here is the Fourier transform of that function. See, this is the, view this as the Fourier factor, and that is the function being Fourier transformed, because that has a non-trivial tau dependence, right? So that has the trivial tau dependence, always just a plane wave. We can view this as a Fourier factor. And that has a non-trivial tau dependence when the path is non-trivial. Then the Fourier transform of this will be a function depending on En, which will in general have some zero crossings, which means that there are some energies, En, which cannot occur as an excitation. The probability for excitation to that energy would be zero. But generically, that function would not be, the Fourier transform of that function would not vanish for most energies where the detector could go into, and that means a possibility for excitation. You see, the Ex is just a name for the energy gap of the detector. For that, it's the Fourier transformed variable Ex. Right. So, and that is the famous Unruh effect. That's the effect that for generic trajectories, the probability for finding the detector excited and one photon present in the field, even if the detector started in the ground state and the field in the vacuum, that probability generically is non-zero. See, this is a much stronger statement than the statement that a detector that's accelerated uniformly will see a certain temperature. You would sometimes find the Unruh effect as saying that if the detector is accelerated at a constant rate, then it will be excited as if it were exposed to a certain temperature that is proportional to the acceleration. But you see, that's just a special case. What we see here is that it's a much more general effect. Even if the acceleration is non-uniform, and more importantly, even if the acceleration is only temporary, this already will lead to this Fourier transform not giving you directly a Dirac delta. And therefore, generically, there will be some excitation. I'm making that point because many derivations of the Unruh effect work differently. They don't use the, and I will have to say more about that other approach later, they will not use Unruh de Witt detectors, but instead they will use Bogoliubov transformations. They will look for particle acceleration, a particle creation in a way that's similar to what we did with the in and out states of harmonic oscillators with driven forces. And then the calculation becomes harder, and it can basically only be done when the acceleration is uniform. And then you make some special arguments that apply only when it's uniform acceleration, presence of horizon and things like that. And then you get a conclusion about excitation, and it turns out to be of a finer temperature. But from that other derivation that I'll later talk about more, it could seem as if the presence of a horizon was necessary for the Andrew effect to occur. But from this calculation, we see it's not necessary. The acceleration could be temporary and not uniform at all, and still, generically, we always have some Andrew effect. Okay, so in the case of a constantly accelerated detector, one finds that the probability of excitation is identical to the case in which a detector is in a heat bath of temperature T, which is essentially the acceleration. You just have to use some constant prefactors that will make the units come out right. I'd like to leave it to you as an assigned reading to read pages 52 and 58 of the textbook by Birrell and Davies. They basically continue the calculation that I presented today. And what they will do there is they will say, okay, let us allow for arbitrary states of the field. All one particle states could be out states, but we fixed for one. We calculate the probability that we find that the detector is excited to that state and the field is excited to one photon with momentum k tilde. And they said, well, let's trace over all possibilities and let's calculate not the probability amplitude, but the probability. In this way, you have to do an extra integral because you have to square the probability amplitude to get the probability, and you get an expression that can be carried out explicitly if the acceleration is uniform. And then you find that same result, namely that the detector gets excited at the same rate as if it were exposed to a heat bath of temperature alpha. So that's reassuring that you get the same result as what you would get with the Brillouin transformation. Let me just make a brief comment. Well, all right. I mean, we talked about this before, that the same calculation can be used, the same approach that we use today can be used to calculate all sorts of absorption and emission processes. This is just writing out the example of starting the field in a one particle, one photon state, and then the atom can absorb it. But I'd like to give you a little bit more of a hint of what the alternative intuition is when you do it with the Brillouin of transformations. Remember that when we talked about the quantum harmonic oscillators, and we said that they can be driven externally, they can be driven parametrically, and so on. And so we had this driven harmonic oscillators. They started out in a certain in state and then ended up in a certain out state. At the basis of that was the idea that we take the quantum field and we decompose it into individual uncoupled harmonic oscillators, right? Now, when you have Minkowski space, that's what we did. We have the outcome. Now, imagine you are, however, an accelerated observer, and you set up, you're not just an atom that's being accelerated. No, you set up a whole coordinate system that's accelerated along with you. In this case, for the accelerated observer, what appears to be, for the accelerated observer, a mode of the Minkowski observer doesn't appear to be monochromatic. It doesn't appear to be of constant frequency. It's basically the Doppler effect, right? And so for an accelerated observer, his mode decomposition is not going to coincide just by a shift, as would be the case for constant velocity. It's not coincide just by a shift with relative to the mode decomposition of an inertial observer. But instead, there's actually a time-dependent shift. These harmonic oscillators are coupled. And so there's a non-trivial Bogoliubov transformation between the mode decomposition of an inertial observer and an accelerated observer. And you can calculate that. And in this way, you can also derive the Andrew effect. You see particle creation in the same sense as we had it earlier with the Bogoliubov transformation. Anyway, I will say More about this later on in the course. But I just want to give you this interpretation as well, because again, the way that I just put it doesn't rely on the existence of a horizon. And you see, ultimately, this is of importance when it comes to black holes, because there we are not so sure about things. And it's good to view the things that we are sure about, such as the Andrew effect, from as many directions as possible, so that we have a better intuition for what to expect when we come to Hawking radiation. Okay, so that's it for today.